Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we're looking at a really profound framework for understanding chronic illness, one that kind of challenges the very foundations of how we think about modern healthcare. And there's this paradox at the center of it, isn't there? Modern medicine is. It's incredible in a crisis.
Oh, absolutely.
If you have a heart attack, a major infection, the rescue is often miraculous.
Right.
Yet the burden of chronic diseases, things like diabetes, autoimmunity, heart failure, chronic fatigue, it just keeps rising. I mean, exponentially.
Yeah.
We're better than ever at measuring the body, but are we actually making people fundamentally healthier?
And that is the central question. You know, the sources we've been analyzing argue that our metrics are actually misleading us.
How so?
They say this rising chronic disease burden reflects a systemic failure in something they call regulatory coherence. We've been treating the wreckage, you know, the broken organ.
The symptom.
Exactly. Yeah. When the real disease started long, long ago, it was a problem of the whole system's governance.
Okay, let's just jump right into that core idea then. The sources make a big distinction between two words that sound similar: performance and capacity.
Right.
In this context, what's the difference? And why has medicine focused so much on one over the other?
Well, performance is the now. It's the snapshot.
The lab result.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
It's what your body is doing at this very moment. Is your blood pressure under 130? Is your blood sugar in the right range? We love performance because you can measure it. It's actionable today.
But capacity is different.
Capacity is the deep resource.
Yeah.
It's the unmeasured variable. It's the ability of your system to take a hit like the flu or a huge financial stressor and then bounce back to baseline without permanent damage.
Hey, so can you give me an example? Someone who has great performance, but their capacity is just shot.
Oh, sure. Think of the classic high-achieving executive, pushing 80-hour weeks, running on caffeine, sleeping maybe 4 hours a night.
Right.
But their annual physical comes back, and, you know, their blood pressure is fine, their cholesterol is great. Their system is meeting the performance target.
Yeah. But it's costing them something.
It's costing them everything. They're doing it through constant, heroic, high-cost compensation. There's just no flexibility left. And the sources point out that you can keep up that facade of performance right until you hit a wall.
A point they call saturation.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The second you hit saturation, the collapse.
Yeah.
It looks so sudden from the outside. But really, it was just the visible end of a long, slow, invisible erosion of capacity.
That makes so much sense. And it feeds right into the next problem the sources identify, which is this trap of organ-centered thinking.
Mm-hmm.
We divide the body up. We go to a cardiologist for the heart, an endocrinologist for hormones. And it creates this illusion that the disease actually starts in that organ.
And look, the reductionism is brilliant for certain things. If you need to fix a broken heart valve, it's perfect. But for chronic systems failure, it cripples us.
Because the systems aren't separate.
They're not separate machines. The sources describe them as overlapping projections of the same living regulatory web. It's like you're looking at the same complex tapestry, just from different angles.
So treating one organ is like trying to treat the smoke without even looking for the fire.
That's a great way to put it.
Can you give us an example that really breaks those boundaries?
Heart failure is the perfect one. By the time the heart muscle itself is weak, that's just the final actuator failing. It's way downstream.
So what else is going on?
Well, heart failure is also a disorder of how the kidneys handle salt because of bad signals from the nervous system. It's a disorder of autonomic tone. The heart is being told to run too fast all the time. It's a disorder of chronic immune activation, of sleep, of mitochondrial stress.
Wow.
The heart is just the final common pathway for a network failure that spans like 4 different medical specialties.
So the big mistake is that our current model is great at explaining what breaks.
Mm.
But it just can't explain how a system drifts toward that breaking point over time.
Time. That's the missing axis. And the master coordinator that pulls all this together across time, that's the autonomic nervous system. And that takes us to the ancient survival blueprints.
Okay.
So the autonomic nervous system, it's not just a simple on-off switch between, you know, rest and fight. It's a stacked hierarchical architecture. It's been built up over 500 million years of evolution.
And the sources map this to something called the polyvagal hierarchy.
Right, which basically dictates how the body spends its energy based on whether it feels safe or threatened.
So let's walk through that stack, starting with the oldest, deepest layer.
That's the dorsal vagal system. This is the most ancient logic we have. Think jawless fish. It's the strategy of conservation.
What does that mean, conservation?
It means if you can't fight and you can't flee, the system just imposes metabolic austerity. It's profound immobility. It's feigning death. It's a total metabolic shutdown.
So it's the play possum response, the global circuit breaker.
Precisely. It's intelligent. It's protective. And it is uncompromising. Then on top of that, evolution built the sympathetic system.
This is the one we all know, fight or flight.
The engine of mobilization, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It rapidly shifts energy around, boosts cardiac output, floods the body with fuel. It's all about immediate action.
And then there's a third layer, which is newer.
Much newer. The ventral vagal system. This is the mammalian upgrade. It's a sophisticated break.
A break.
Yeah, it mediates what they call the social engagement system.
Mm-hmm.
Its key job is to allow you to be physiologically calm while you're still behaviorally open and engaged. It's what lets us bond, repair our immune system, digest our food. It's the master conductor of safety.
The key thing here, then, is that these aren't just three options. They operate in a strict hierarchy.
A strict order of precedence. They act as the sovereign treasury of our biological capital. They are gating mechanisms that decide which system gets to spend our energy.
And it gets even more detailed. The sources break down the sympathetic system itself into three functional zones.
Right. It's not monolithic. It's segmented. You have T1 to T5, P6 to T12, and then L1 to L2.
Let's start at the top, the cardiopulmonary power band, T1 to T5. What happens when that gets dysregulated?
Well, T1 to T5 governs the heart and lungs, our engines. When that ventral vagal brake fails, this band just goes ungated. The heart is told to run flat out all the time, even when there's no physical reason.
You see this in panic attacks.
Panic attacks, hyperadrenergic dysautonomia, early heart failure. The heart is just being overemployed because the central controller won't let it rest.
Okay, what about the middle zone, the metabolic allocation band, T6 to T12? This seems like it would be key for modern diseases.
Oh, absolutely. T6 to T12 is in charge of the liver, pancreas, gut, kidney. It's all about survival economics. And when it's chronically activated, you get the physiology of permanent anticipation, permanent scarcity.
So the body thinks it's starving, even when it's not.
It's always preparing for a famine that never comes.
And the lowest band, L1 to L2, the pelvic containment band.
That governs continence, sexuality, pelvic floor tone. Chronic guarding in this area often reflects stored survival strategies, usually from some kind of unintegrated trauma, physical or emotional. The body is just locking down a critical boundary because it still perceives a threat, maybe decades later.
This is incredible. And this is where the sources shift from a pure biology into the language of systems engineering, control theory.
Yes.
This is the piece that ties all these evolutionary systems to the actual mechanics of why we get sick.
And if you speak the language of control theory, you can define these disease states with incredible precision. The body is a control system. It has sensors, controllers, and actuators.
So let's define these pathological dynamics. The sources list four of them. Let's start with gain and damping.
Okay. So gain is just how strongly the system responds to an error. If you have high vascular gain, a tiny bit of stress gives you a huge spike in blood pressure. That's hypertension.
And damping.
Damping is how smoothly the system settles back down after it's been disturbed. You know, health is high variability, a smooth return to baseline. Pathological damping is rigidity. The system either gets stuck high or it just swings wildly out of control.
And then you get to the physical limits, the point you mentioned earlier, saturation.
This is so critical. Saturation is when the actuator, the working part, like the heart muscle or the beta cells in the pancreas, hits its absolute maximum output.
It's redlining.
It's redlining, but the controller keeps demanding more. And this is where physical damage really starts to accelerate because you're pushing the components way beyond their design limits.
Which leads to the most destructive one of all, the one that basically guarantees a collapse. Integrator windup. That sounds complicated.
It sounds technical, but I can give you an analogy. Imagine you're using a credit card, but your bank account is empty.
Okay.
And the bank, the controller, just keeps approving the charges.
Yeah.
It accumulates this massive uncorrected error, this debt.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, the card, the actuator, is completely maxed out. It's saturated.
So there's this huge debt just sitting there, invisible.
Exactly, just waiting. And then something happens, an infection, a job loss, some big emotional stressor. The constraints break, and that stored command, that massive debt, discharges catastrophically. The system is suddenly hit with years of accumulated debt all at once.
That is a terrifyingly clear analogy. It just makes so much sense. Let's apply that to type 2 diabetes. It's not just a sugar problem.
Not at all. It's a disorder of that T6, T12 sympathetic band. The physiology of scarcity, the constant perceived threat makes the liver just dump fuel into the bloodstream nonstop.
Creating this metabolic overload.
Right. And so the cells, seeing this constant flood of fuel, they react by becoming insulin resistant.
So resistance is actually a protective measure.
The sources argue it's often the cell's last act of cell protection. It's the cell saying, no more deliveries. Because the nervous system is screaming, we're in a famine, release everything. And it's just flooding the market.
And heart failure becomes the end stage of that saturation and windup.
Decades of forced mobilization pushes the heart past its limits. The heart hits saturation, but the brain keeps demanding more output, accumulating that windup debt, the final diagnosis.
Yeah.
That's just the catastrophic discharge of that debt.
Okay, what about autoimmunity? How does the model explain the immune system attacking itself?
Autoimmunity, in this framework, is a problem of a loss of inhibitory damping.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that the immune system is making a mistake in what it sees.
It's that it can't shut off.
It's stuck in the on position.
Yeah.
That ventral vagal system we talked about. It provides a powerful anti-inflammatory break. When that break is gone, the immune system just keeps cycling, reinforcing its own error signal because nothing is there to damp it down.
And finally, something like chronic fatigue syndrome or post-viral collapse. Historically, so misunderstood.
This model sees it as the end stage of control system heroics. The system isn't weak. It's incredibly wise.
Yeah.
It has imposed a protective energy embargo.
A shutdown.
A shutdown. It flips into that deep dorsal dominant conservation mode to prevent lethal self-destruction from windup.
That completely reframes post-exertional malaise, or PEM. The crash you feel after doing too much. It isn't a symptom of weakness.
It's the signature of forbidden spending. The system enforcing a strict economic policy. And this, you know, this leads to a really profound clinical insight from the material.
Which is?
Stress management isn't enough. It just treats symptoms. True repair requires, and I'm quoting here, restoration of accurate sensing and reauthorizing ventral vagal governance.
So you need safety before you can heal.
And you need sequence. For example, stable restorative sleep has to come back online before the system will even consider allowing stamina to return.
This is all happening inside the body, but now we have to look outside. The nervous system isn't just a controller, it's a receiver.
It's an ecological seismograph of the world around us. And at a population level, chronic disease isn't just a collection of individual failures. It reflects the moral and regulatory architecture of our civilization.
Our environment is actively pushing our control systems toward disease. Can you give us some specific examples of this ecological incoherence?
Sure. Let's take economic insecurity. Living paycheck to paycheck isn't just a mental stress. It's a constant metabolic signal to that T6, T12 band that says future survival is unreliable.
The body can't tell the difference between being chased by a tiger and not being able to pay rent.
It can't. So it activates that scarcity physiology. It holds on to every resource. Poverty, from a control theory perspective, is a chronic metabolic threat state.
That is just staggering. It connects our social reality directly to the mechanism of metabolic disease. What about social isolation?
Isolation is an autonomic toxin. That new ventral vagal safety break, it relies heavily on cues from other people co-regulation. Loneliness suppresses that ventral vagal tone.
Which takes the brakes off.
Takes the brakes off the immune system, makes it more inflammatory, takes the brakes off the heart, making it more prone to arrhythmia. You can literally measure the inflammatory signals of loneliness.
And work. The sources mention coercive metrics.
Yeah. Think about work that involves unpredictable schedules, constant surveillance, impossible deadlines. That kind of environment trains chronic sympathetic dominance.
And no chance for restoration.
None. The nervous system never gets a signal of safety. An economy that demands constant output without structurally protecting recovery is, and this is a quote, anti-life at the control level. It forces our biology to accumulate windup as the price of just participating.
So where does this leave us? It feels like this reframing means chronic disease isn't an individual moral failing. It's not about not having enough willpower.
Not at all.
It's the physiological testimony of a society that has, whether we meant to or not, just broken the fundamental rules of living systems.
Exactly. And the positive vision here is that a coherent civilization would treat recovery as a first-order variable. That means designing systems in our jobs, in healthcare, in housing, that structurally protect predictability, restoration, and safety, because those things are required for biological solvency.
What a journey. I mean, we've gone from seeing the body as a collection of broken parts to seeing it as this elegant, complex control system, an overwhelmed control system, but one whose failure is actually predictable if we understand the rules.
Mm-hmm.
And health, then, isn't about being perfectly stable. It's the flexibility to move fluidly between these different survival modes, not getting stuck in one.
And that flexibility, that capacity, It leads directly to what I think is the deepest ethical takeaway from all this work. The core question for the 21st century is no longer just about freedom or equality. It's about whether we will choose to design systems, economic, social, technological, that are compatible with the ancient control architecture of living things, or whether we will continue to build systems that require our bodies to become dysregulated and sick as the mandatory price of admission. That choice, more than any single drug or device, is what will shape the health of all of us for the next 100 years.